It is analysis on the state Supreme Court race here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. If Judge Brian Hagedorn's lead holds, the state Supreme Court could have a conservative majority for years to come. Here he is declaring victory at a news conference yesterday in Pewaukee.
I was wanting to get key partisan politics out of the Supreme Court. I don't want to see the court be a, you know, political playground for anybody on the left or the right. It's a place where we are to do law and be faithful to the law.
We're looking at balance of power and the influence of the state's high court on Wisconsinites. Do you think there should be a recount or not? Why? And when you consider the future of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, what do you think the state needs? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ryan Owens is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of the Tommy G. Thompson Center on Public Leadership. He specializes in the Constitution, courts, and law. Ryan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So the Supreme Court race still too close to call. Governor Evers was with us yesterday on our program, and here he is talking about the possibility of a recount for the state Supreme Court election.
It certainly appears to be close enough that a recount is likely. I know everybody that voted, even those that did not vote, want every vote to count, and so it's likely to be a recount, and we'll just have to wait and talk to that to declare a victory.
So, Ryan, how likely do you think it is that there will be a recount for this election?
Well, I think under the law, Judge Neubauer is entitled to a recount. You know, anything where the difference is less than 1%, you're entitled to request it. Anything that's less than a quarter of a percentage point, you don't have to pay for it. The state would pay for it. As far as I can tell right now, it's outside that quarter point percentile. So she's entitled to a recount. She'd have to pay for it. And it seems to me, you know, she's likely to ask for it.
Well, recounts rarely change election results. What is the point of a recount? What's the motivation?
Well, I mean, that's a good point. I think, you know, given where they are right now with that vote difference, it seems incredibly unlikely that that she'd be able to find enough votes, so to speak, to flip that. You know, what's the point? I think, you know, for a lot of people, look, you know, they've invested a lot of time and sweat and energy into this, and they want to make sure that, you know, by God, this is actually what it looks to be. And so there's a little bit of that, and there's also just, you know, signaling to your donors, to your followers, to your supporters that, you know, I'm still in this for the long haul, and so, you know, it's a bit of a signaling mechanism there as well.
Well, she signaled that she is in for the long haul. She posted a video on Facebook yesterday indicating she'll push for a recount. Let's hear some of that.
We faced an unprecedented deluge of last-minute outside dark money spending, more than $1 million in the last week alone. And so now, the morning after the election, this race is still too close to call.
So she's talking about dark money spending and the election results. Can you explain to us what she's referring to there?
Well, I mean, for starters, I just, you know, that that point, it's hard, frankly, to take that seriously. You know, she outspent Hagedorn by roughly $2 million, as far as I could tell on this. You know, groups that supported her came in. I think it was an incredibly lopsided spending, if you look at it. So, I mean, there wasn't nearly as much spending on Hagedorn's behalf as there was on Neubauer's. So, you know, this you know, concern is a little strange. It is correct that at the last minute he did receive some spending, some, you know, third party groups coming in and spending money on his behalf. But when you look at the totals on this, I mean, she outspent him by millions of dollars. So, you know, that's just more of a campaigning strategy, I think, to make those comments. And, you know, again, she's entitled to a recount under the law. And, you know, we have a process for this. If it's a close election, there's a recount. It's a good process. We need to let it work. But at the end of the day, it doesn't seem as though there's going to be enough there to kind of switch the results of this.
Do you think outside money made this a more partisan-focused election?
More than what?
More than, I mean, this is supposed to be a nonpartisan election, but do you think these outside groups influenced and made it more of a focus on partisanship?
Partisanship? No, not at all. I didn't see any ads in there talking about, you know, Republicans or Democrats. If it's about ideology, then perhaps. But this happens all the time in these races and nonpartisan, particularly in nonpartisan races. You know, and the Supreme Court has, the U.S. Supreme Court has weighed in on this and said that these groups have a First Amendment right to do it. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways that states can select their Supreme Court justices. They can do it with partisan elections. They can do it with nonpartisan elections, you know, in appointments and a handful of other mechanisms. And, you know, you're never going to get money out of these things. People are entitled to spend on behalf of the candidates of their choice. So it just, you know, it is what it is. There are certainly a handful of things that you could do to make things clearer potentially for voters. But yeah, this is how it operates, and this is how it has operated for years.
Talking with Ryan Owens, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and talking about the Supreme Court election, are you concerned about dark money in campaigns? Do you think it influenced this state's Supreme Court election or not? Hagedorn voters, Neubauer voters, non-voters, we want to hear your thoughts on this undecided election at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ryan Owens, what are some of the things that would make it more clear for voters? You know, what are some things that you could do to provide clarity?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things that different states do. Some states actually run partisan elections for their state Supreme Courts. And so when you go in and you vote for state Supreme Court justice, you can see that there's an R or a D next to somebody's name. You know, that, of course, has the effect of informing voters who, you know, a candidate is, sort of what their general philosophy is. And it's right there on the ballot. It's a heuristic, a shortcut that people can use. Some people have argued that gives a little bit more power to the candidates and to the voters to let them know exactly who the person is. You know, because when you go into a voting booth and you don't know who a candidate is, you know, who is this person? If you see that R, the D, that kind of gives you some information. And if you don't have that information, some have argued that, you know, you're more reliant than on outside spending by third parties. Another thing that states could do, you know, I lived in Massachusetts for a little while. A lot of times they would send you, the state would send voting materials to voters about who the candidates were, giving you a short blurb about what they stand for, that sort of thing. You know, that's something that could be done as well. That's a policy decision. I'm not supporting one or the other, but those are options out there.
And before we go into a break here, what do we know about when we would know whether there is a recount?
Shortly. I haven't looked at the statutory language on this, but I think if they're going to declare that you want one, you've got to do it within a time period. So that's likely to be soon.
We're talking about the state Supreme Court race as Judge Brian Hagedorn holds a narrow lead with a possibility of a recount looming. Ryan Owens stays with us. He's a UW-Madison political science professor and director of the Tommy G. Thompson Center on Public Leadership. Do you think there should be a recount for the Supreme Court race? Why or why not? Do you think Judge Hagedorn should just be declared the winner since he does have a narrow majority? Or do you think it's too close to call? Join in with your thoughts, your questions on the election at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the state Supreme Court election here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With all the precincts reporting, Judge Brian Hagedorn led Judge Lisa Neubauer by just under 6,000 votes out of more than 1.2 million votes counted. Wisconsin has no automatic recounts. Here is Judge Hagedorn yesterday responding to the possibility of a recount at a press conference in Pewaukee where he declared victory.
If a recount happens, absolutely. We'll be prepared financially. We'll be prepared legally. to do that, and we'll already be making all the preparations necessary for that.
We're talking about the possibility of a recount and what that looks like. We're talking about the court's balance of power and the impact of money on elections. Do you worry about spending on campaigns? Hagedorn voters, Neubauer voters, non-voters, we want to hear your thoughts on this undecided election. Do you think it influenced this state Supreme Court election or not? We're at 800-642-1234. UW-Madison political science professor Ryan Owens stays with us. Ryan, you know, how big of a deal would a recount be? How many times has this happened in the past, Supreme Court elections?
It has happened in the past. It's not commonplace. Obviously, you know, most elections aren't quite this close, but it has happened in the past, and you gotta just let this process work itself out. I think as a winner, you know, Hagedorn of course wants to be cautious that that there aren't any sort of shenanigans or something in the recount process, and that's not likely to occur. So it's got some legitimacy enhancing benefits to this. As the winner, you go through this again, you say, sure, of course, you know, we'll do a recount, and after that recount is done, what's likely to be the case is declared the victor, then yeah, go ahead. He's got more legitimacy at that point. And so that's likely to be what happens here.
And Michael called in to ask, unable to stay with us, he wants to know, with these recalls, are taxpayers on the hook?
Well, again, if the recount is a quarter of a percentage point, if the margin is a quarter of a percentage point less, then the taxpayers are. If not, then it's the candidates.
So let's look at recusals for a moment. It's an issue that's come up recently. The League of Women Voters even asked the candidates about it. And regardless of which, you know, how this all ends, will recusals continue to be a big issue for the state Supreme Court?
Well, it might be. I think there are outside groups that are interested in this. A lot of times their motivations are good. Other times I think their motivations are frankly to try to, sort of whittle away at judicial elections. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying it's a thing. So we kind of want to keep an eye on this. There are different motivations for why you bring up the recusal issue. The court sort of looked at this a few years ago, decided not to move forward with it. I can't imagine that's going to change anytime soon. It's an issue out there.
Have justices handled recusals differently? Is it up to the justice? How does that work?
It's certainly different across the states and at the national level. I think the predominant thing here is usually it's a decision that the justices make independently by themselves. There are some guidelines that are out there for them to look at in terms of the appearance of fairness and that kind of thing. It tends to be an individual level decision made by the justices. The fact of the matter is, it's not something that they take lightly. We elect seven people to sit on our Supreme Court, and I think most people would agree you probably don't want them dropping from cases, with a regular frequency, because, they're there in the Constitution. We want them there. There's something called the rule of necessity, which means that judges on a court of last resort ought to sit unless there's a very clear reason for them not to.
Well, Shana from Green Bay wants to look at the politics of this election. Shana, hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I was calling because I was just thinking about the recent gubernatorial election and Tony Evers being elected, and I'm curious what the guest would say about in the past when governor of the other party is elected, if the Supreme Court elections often go to the other leaning candidate.
Great question, Shana. What do we know about this, Ryan?
Yeah, thanks, Shana. Well, you know, this is a trend that we see at the national level as well. So, you know, anytime there's a new president and the next election, sort of the midterm type election, you do see a spike in turnout from the other party. I think in this election here, that mattered. So if you look at the 2018 midterm elections, Republicans played defense basically everywhere in Wisconsin. They had to defend Trump's record. They had to defend Walker's record. And a lot of time that's hard to do. So, you know, I think Democrats had a bit of an advantage in 2018 in those terms. And now when you look at the election here just a couple of days ago, you know, Republicans, conservatives, they weren't out there having to defend Trump. Now it was sort of more of an even playing field. In fact, you know, one might argue that conservatives had a bit of an advantage because now they were able to see Tony Evers' budget and some of his proposals. They were able to react to that. They were able to see what some of the national Democrats are talking about sort of in the lead up to their primaries, and they were able to react to that. And then, of course, you had the comments about Hagedorn's past, and, you know, he linked that up to an attack on his Christian faith. They're able to react to that. So I think that there were some turnout mechanisms here that, that helped conservatives that we didn't see in 2018, and that tends to motivate the base to come out and vote.
Ryan, let's look at balance of power on the court. If Hagedorn does end up being the official winner, what will be the significance of that 5-2 conservative majority?
Well, you know, it remains to be seen yet in terms of doctrinal approaches. I think a lot of people would point out that there are differences between the conservatives just in general judicial philosophy. I think you've seen certainly among the four that are there right now, Bradley and Kelly are more similar to one another. And then you have Rogensack and Ziegler who are still, you know, conservatives, but they don't have the same kinds of jurisprudential philosophy. So we've seen a little bit of a break between those two camps there among the conservatives. I think Hagedorn would come in likely to be more like a Bradley or a Kelly. So I think those are the doctrinal consequences of this. But in terms of just the political balance and power going forward, look, I mean, this is huge for conservatives. Had they lost this seat, that gives them a 4-3 majority on the court. And then, you know, 2020, Dan Kelly's seat is up. He can certainly win that that election, but it's going to be difficult. Democrats are going to be motivated. That election will be held at the same time as Democrats go in to cast their votes in the primary for Democratic presidential selection. So, you know, it would be tough. And if they had lost that seat, it would have flipped 4-3 conservative to 4-3 liberal. Conservatives and Republicans wouldn't have had a chance to win that back until 2025. So this is a pretty significant victory.
And these judges have decade-long terms, and the timing would be then significant for that next election since it falls on a cycle when perhaps there's more turnout.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Again, you know, that's certainly not to prejudge it. It's quite possible that, you know, Kelly could win that reelection. We don't know yet what's going to be on that election other than, you know, the Democratic primary. It could be that there's, you know, a ballot initiative that could get conservatives out there. You know, we have no idea whether Donald Trump is going to try to get involved with a Democratic primary one way or the other. And if he does that, whether or not he sort of gins up behavior among his base to kind of come in and vote in the Democratic primary. So it's just, we don't really know yet for sure, but what we do know is that securing this victory was tremendous for conservatives.
We were talking to your colleague yesterday, Barry Burden, and he's saying, you know, it's interesting that turnout is light for these nonpartisan elections because their impact is so great on our day-to-day life when you are electing mayors and local offices and school referendums. Is there something to that?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, all of these public offices are important, and we should treat them as such. Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with that at all.
Well, as you watch this play out, and perhaps a recount, perhaps not, what are you watching for?
Well, there's a few things. I mean, some takeaways from the election. The first is that, you know, grassroots politics still matters a lot. Republicans and conservatives came out to vote quite a bit the other night, and I don't think people expected that to happen. So a lot of people, I think, were caught by surprise by that. And so definitely coordinated efforts still matter. Money can buy a lot of things, but it doesn't always buy victory. Neubauer's campaign, again, outspent Hagedorn's by a considerable margin. And, you know, campaigns still matter. Grassroots still matter. The other thing I'm looking at, too, is the voting patterns in across the state, but in particular, if you look at Dane County and Milwaukee.
And we'll have to end it right there, Ryan Owens. Thank you so much. Ryan Owens, professor of political science at UW-Madison, directs the Tommy G. Thompson Center on Public Leadership. Coming up next, if you need frozen pizza, Wisconsin's got you covered. We'll talk about frozen pizza with a food writer. This is the Ideas Network. Talking about Wisconsin's frozen pizza dominance here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is notable. Get this. Wisconsin is the largest per capita pizza consumer in the U.S. And that's according to the product development director at Nestle's frozen pizzas division. What is your favorite Wisconsin-based frozen pizza brand? Why? Is it the crust, the quality of the ingredients, the name? What is your favorite type of frozen pizza? Give us a shout out, 800-642-1234. Daniel Higgins is the food and drink reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. His recent article is titled, Great Cheese and Big Appetites Make Wisconsin a Frozen Pizza Leader. Dan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me back.
So you like get to be paid to write long and go deep on pizza. What gives?
That's just the wonderful part of my job. I have great editors who let me kind of explore these kinds of topics. So
what piqued your interest in frozen pizza?
I was at Festival Foods, and I'm just looking at the pizza aisle, and there's this frozen pizza, Kingpin frozen pizza. It's got a little bowling pin on it. And I took a look at it. I'm like, well, that's kind of a kitschy little thing, and I realized that as I read the description a little bit closer, that this was actually from Ashwaubenon Bowling Alley.
Wait, you're reading the pizza box. You're reading the marketing copy on the pizza box. Just check.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Correct.
Yeah.
I'm just like, what? Why? I'm trying to figure out why or where is this coming from, and I realized that this is the pizza recipe that they use up at the bowling alley in Ashwaubenon there. And it was made by Hanson Foods, who is like, in essence, a contract pizza make. Part of their business is contract pizza making. If you've got a pizza recipe, you can bring it to them. They'll make, you know, give them the recipe, and they'll put it together and package it and everything for you to distribute. And I was just thinking, wow, we're in a state where a bowling alley has a frozen pizza in a freezer, you know, out in the market. And then I kind of looked up and down the aisle and realized the entire freezer case was nothing but frozen pizzas. And I just started to think, okay, is this, I don't want to say abnormal, but is this unusual to have this much frozen pizzas? And I started thinking, well, you won't go into Woodman's. And it's just frozen pizzas forever in there.
So and I can see you. I can see you with your reporter's pad, and you start taking inventory on all the pizzas you're seeing, right? And you're pulling each one out, and at some point, someone's going to come up to you and be like, "What are you doing?"
Well, fortunately, nope, I didn't have quite that experience, but yeah, I'm sure. Someone have been watching me closely. I'm sure they've been like, why is this guy looking at every single pizza as they go through and reading the label and putting it back?
I'm like, well,
yeah, absolutely.
So national brands like DiGiorno and Tombstone and Jack's are apparently all made here and are these local and regional favorites like the Bowling Alley Pizza. What do you think makes Wisconsin the frozen pizza leader?
There's a few things. First of all, I think we were just had some success with early adapters. I think, you know, we're not too far removed from pizza being an exotic food. communities. It wasn't like as ubiquitous as it is now. And I think, you know, Tombstone really hit a recipe, had a lot of success with it. The Simic brothers are just did a great job of building that brand from in Medford to being a national brand. I mean, by the late 70s, they were already into 15 states with their frozen pizza. You know, you had Jack's over in the Little Chute area, too, kind of building the same reputation. So it was part of that reputation, but I also think, you know, when you're this close to really good mozzarella cheese from our dairy, from our cheesemakers, that certainly helps. That was something that came up several times with people I talked to. They talked about, you know, that mozzarella cheese and having that, and when that's a big part of pizzas, obviously.
Yeah, very smooth supply chain access when you've got your cows in the backyard. You got that cheese all right here. So yeah. apparently you talked to someone in the know at Nestle in the frozen pizzas division, and they said that we're the largest per capita pizza consumer in the U.S.?
Correct. That's what he said. His working theory, and this is kind of fun, was he thought maybe it's actually our Norwegian ancestry, because he said Norway just is like the only place out of the United States that has a higher per capita consumption of frozen pizzas than the United States. So he thinks maybe that it's something in our blood. Maybe we're just born to really love this stuff.
Someone needs to write a dissertation on this. I can just feel it. We're talking with Dan Higgins. He's food and drink reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's been writing about Wisconsin's frozen pizza dominance, and we're getting into the history with your thoughts on your favorite frozen pizza at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite type of frozen pizza? Are you a meat lover? Do you prefer veggies, veggie delight? Light, a mixture of the two, perhaps you're just plain cheese. What's a frozen pizza you've had that was good and would really surprise people to know it's good? We're at 800-642-1234. Give a shout out. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Dan, let's talk about Palermo's rise. Where are they based and how did they get their start?
They're down in the Milwaukee area. They actually started as a bakery. And then turn into like a pizzeria, and then they had like a locally owned, you know, pizzeria. And one time, at one point, a grocery or a retailer kind of, went to the owners and had them try this, a French bread pizza. And he kind of said, this is not good. And we can, and the retailer's like, well, that's the point. You guys could do this so much better. And so they ended up converting an old building into a factory and started making their frozen pizzas. And then kind of the same way, just started to build out. You know, it seems like a lot of these were bars. You know, the Tombstone started in bars. Palermo's got, you know, kind of built up in bars. And even now when I talk to Home Run Pizza in Appleton, he said, you know, they're in a lot of bars more so than the, you know, so I think that maybe that's part of it too.
Pizza just tastes better in bars? I don't know.
With beer.
With beer, right?
I mean, come on. And it's an easy thing. You can have just a little pizza oven. You don't need a whole big, you know, kitchen set up to make a frozen pizza in the bar setting.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
I'm sure that helps. So anyway, they just kind of built from there, and then they got innovative too. I mean, they're actually the first ones to hit the market with a rice and crust pizza.
That was back in 89.
Yeah. So that was even a few years before DiGiorno kind of hit the nationwide market with it. But yeah, they, you know, then they went to ultra thin crust, and they're always innovating. They've got several lines now. And I think they've got a good sense of how to meet the demands of the market. You know, I think some people now want, if you want pizzas with lower calories, you know, you can go with like a thinner crust, or if you're looking for one that's more clean label, well, they've got a line of pizzas that kind of meet that demand in the market. What people want from frozen pizza diversifies. You know, they've been able to really kind of provide pizzas to meet all those different demands.
Let's go to Nancy joining us from Superior. Hi, Nancy. good. So what about your favorite frozen pizza?
Oh, I just have to tell you, I'm 50, so I have some experience behind me. And I'm from Wisconsin, so it's all about cheese. And let me tell you, the home run pizza, just the cheese home run pizza, is one of the best pizzas I have found to date.
Okay, so you're talking about home run pizza and not home run in frozen pizza.
Uh-oh, I might have forgotten the in.
Well, yeah. Well, because Dan can distinguish here. Dan, go ahead.
Oh, God.
Yeah, home run in is actually, they're a Chicago, I mean, it's a very good frozen pizza. I'm not gonna sit here. But they're actually a Chicago-based one, and there's home run pizza, which is an Appleton one that kind of grew out of, like, this fundraising effort for a church and ended up building into, like, this frozen pizza, smaller. It's kind of more of a localized pizza company here in Appleton. But, yes, definitely Home Run Inn does make some nice frozen pizzas.
Oh, yeah, and it's Home Run Inn from Chicago. I've actually been in one of the stores, yep. But the frozen pizzas are amazing. And thanks for that clarification. Yeah, just a fantastic frozen pizza at home.
Nancy, what do you love about it? Is it just because it comes out right each time, or you know, what does it do for you?
Oh, it's the crust. You know, it's a real challenge to find a frozen pizza that has a crust that's not going to be like cardboard, but that has some flavor and personality, as well as a good sauce and just the right amount of cheese. The sauce is key to any pizza.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for that. Dan, you know, there is a lot riding on that crust. So, and do you see a lot of variety out there with frozen pizzas as how they approach crust?
I think so. And that's funny you mentioned that, because I think TNT Crust had commented on our Facebook page about that we didn't talk too much about the crust in the story. I'm like, yeah, I did kind of, but maybe that's a whole other story.
I would say that's like the next crust. Chapter is crust.
Next chapter is that let's talk about the crust and let's talk about the meats too. I think that got mentioned a couple times, but yeah, yes, there is. I think even within, you know, when I was talking to Nestle about, you know, the difference between, you know, the Jack's versus Tombstone versus DiGiorno, and in that's part of it. You know, Jack's has got a much thinner crust. Tombstone's a little bit breadier. And then DiGiorno obviously has those rising type crust or berries or deep dish or whatever. So yeah, there's definitely some more variety in the crust than maybe sometimes people really realize. And maybe there is a whole story there.
We're talking about how Wisconsin dominates the frozen pizza world. Lots of variety in the freezer cases at the grocery store. Dan Higgins sorting it out for us, telling the history, the backstory on frozen pizza. He's food and drink reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. What's a frozen pizza you've had that was so good and you would really surprise people to know it's good? Was it gluten-free? Was it cheeseless? Perhaps the crust made from cauliflower? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Serious stuff here. Wisconsin is a leader in the frozen pizza market segment. We're talking about our rise to dominance and the stories behind frozen pizza brands on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. DiGiorno, owned by Nestle, was the top-ranked frozen pizza brand of the U.S. in 2017 with about $1 billion in sales. What's your favorite Wisconsin-based frozen pizza brand, and why is it? Is it the crust? Is it the cheese, the quality of the ingredients, perhaps the name? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Dan Higgins is the food and drink reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, and he's done rigorous reporting on this topic for the team, and perhaps there will be a new chapter in Wisconsin's frozen pizza history. Let's go to the phones now with Shauna joining us from Friendship. Hi, Shauna.
Good morning. You're making me hungry.
Likewise here. So what is your favorite pizza?
Well, we actually prefer two, Culinary Circle. It's got like a corn-dusted crust, and it's really thick, so it can fill two or three people, just one pizza. And we prefer lots of matzo over that because of the lots of matzo, of course. The more cheese, the better. However, we go by the price point, so whatever they have on sales for the people putting out their new pizzas, especially local pizzas, getting them on sale quite often and get people to try them. Once in a while, we'll still buy them full price because we're craving them, but that's what we drive for.
All right. Well, Shauna, thank you so much. Dan, what do we know about Culinary Circle in Lhotse Matzah?
Lhotse Matzah, I'm trying to think.
Is that Wisconsin or is that not Wisconsin? You need to go back to the freezer case and get read some.
Back. Don't think the other one, the first one, I'm thinking might be a localized one. I don't remember seeing that one out, and then or at least my area. And like I said, I think Lhotse Matzah is.
So I have to ask you. I have to ask you, Dan. Do you buy pizza by price point, or do you just have to go with a certain brand?
It's usually price point because I got kids in the house. And when you got kids and you just need something to fill them up and they're not big, well, okay, my kids are almost completely grown out of the house, but through the years it's just usually been Jack's because those are the ones that would go on sale for the right point and we're like, okay, or an Orv's. Just because, you got kids and they're not, sitting there distinguishing between this ingredient or this topping. It's usually either pepperoni or cheese. But if I were going to buy something, now that I've got to try some of these nicer pizzas that are really pushed the $10 range on a frozen pizza, the quality is really quite good on these. I think a lot of these Wisconsin pizza makers do a nice job of making sure that it's decent quality and they're not just trying to jack up the price and try and get a high margin on things, but I can see where people think, well, why would I spend, $7, $8, $10 on a frozen pizza when I can just pop in a Little Caesars and it's done. I don't have to even cook it or anything or whatever. And I talked to quite a few of them about that, because that was our question I had too as I started looking at the price of some of these. But you start to realize they were pretty big. I mean, a couple of those Pep's Draft House pizzas, they're over 2 pounds.
Oh my goodness!
So it can be quite filling, even though it's $10. It's definitely the kind of pizza that 3-4 people with an average appetites, it's going to fill you up.
Well, let's go to Ben joining us from Little Shoe. Ben, hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
Let's hear it.
Well, I was, I grew up in Little Chute, and I agree with Shauna. I think Brew Pub is an excellent pizza. Also made, they make the Lhotse Matzah. That's in Little Chute as well. But I was saying, I think Jack's Pizza is hard to beat for me. I grew up next to Jack's Pizza plant, so we smell them making it every day. And I think I'm hooked for life. I just can't get it out of my system.
Yep. That's for sure.
Oh my goodness, imagine growing up next to a pizza plant. I don't know, Ben. That's going to taint you for life. Ben, do you still eat pizza?
Sure do.
Okay.
Sure do, and we still live in Little Chute, so once in a while the wind is in the right direction and we get a whiff.
Well, I'm glad it's the wind of pizza and not other things. Let's go to Christina now in Greenfield. Christina, hi.
Hi. I was just calling because I just happen to know that the Lhotse Matzah is made by Brew Pub out of Eau Claire, and it's by far my favorite.
There you go. Thank you so much for helping me out there. I could not get to the internet to double check that one. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. Well, Scott in Madison called in to ask, can you address the market for the take and bake pizza and how that's doing?
I didn't get in specifically to that, and it's kind of interesting too because I think Jack's kind of started that way in the 60s, and then by the early 70s they were over to completely frozen pizzas. So no, I really didn't get into that, and that's a little bit of a different area too. I mean, there's some competition there too. I mean, not just Papa Murphy's, but there's also some smaller places I think out there that do kind of the fresh made pizza where it's not frozen and you can take and bake it.
Can you tell us the backstory of Tombstone?
It started with the Simic brothers. One of them, Pep, his nickname, he was dancing and broke his leg, and they happened to own a bar up in Medford called the Tombstone Tap. It was named that because it was across the street from a cemetery. And while he had kind of this time while he's laid up, he started thinking we should add some pizzas to our bar to make a little bit of extra money. And he tried, I don't know, five of them or so, didn't like any of them, said we can do something better, and they kind of came up with their own sauce recipe and everything else. Did very well at their bar, so then they thought, well, maybe other bars would want to have pizzas like this. So they packed up their cars and drove around to, you know, different taverns, sampling out the pizzas, and the tavern owners saw that, okay, I can make some extra money here, and that's just, and it just kind of kept
traveling pizza off. Salesman.
Yep. Yep.
And then exactly. It was bought by Kraft, which then handed the reins over to Nestle. Did the pizza recipe change a lot as a result of going corporate?
I didn't get a chance to, Joe Simic has, and he died in 2013, Pep Simic. But in an article I came across, he had kind of lamented how Kraft had changed the recipe at one point, and that's why he actually started making some, after his non-compete clause was up, he started making some frozen pizzas again. And now if you see these pizzas called Pep's Draft House pizzas,
mm-hmm.
and they're higher brand, it's supposedly, from what he said, it's the original Tombstone recipe. I obviously don't have access to everybody's recipes to be able to look and over time and be able to see it. So all we have there is kind of his word on.
Yeah, you just got to trust. Yeah. Can't verify.
Right.
Well, let's talk before we go here, short on time, talk about how to properly bake a frozen pizza. What can you tell us?
The biggest thing, and this is what when I talk to Palermo's, and actually when I talk to people at Hanson Foods too, is read the instructions, follow the instructions on the pizza thing, and don't just kind of throw it in and whatever. So whatever the instructions say, follow those. Check your pizza, you know, maybe 10 minutes in. And everybody likes it different too. Some people like it, the cheese just melty. Other people like it a little bit darker. But you know, especially with some of these bigger pizzas, these heavier pizzas, like the Pep's Draft House type pizzas that are over 2 pounds, they need to go usually at a little bit lower temperature for a little bit longer. Otherwise, the edges will get done, and you'll still kind of have that soggy middle. So you need the lower temperature for a little bit longer time to get the heat evenly through the pizzas.
And you have to make sure, too, that your oven is heats at the right temperature as well.
Right.
I mean, our oven runs hot, and so I really have to gauge for that as well.
Exactly, yeah. And you know your oven, and so, yeah, obviously, right, that makes a big difference, too.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Put a pizza in for me, please.
You bet.
Dan Higgins is food and drink reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. His recent article, it is titled Great Cheese and Big Appetites Make Wisconsin a Frozen Pizza Leader. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.